Welcome, Pete. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, great to be here, Todd.
So let me first say you have a fan club, my friend, at CDM. Woohoo, Pete Blaber.
All right. I want to hear more about it, but that's good to know.
People love you. They love the truth and the information and what and actually the time and the effort you put into really trying to bring crystal clear clarity to people. So I think that's what they appreciate. So before we get into Ukraine, let's talk to Middle East. It looks the 82nd's looking to be deployed. I think the Task Force 160th's in the zone, other elements. Karj Island, probably easy to take, but hard to defend troops on the ground there. Your thought?
Yeah, a lot of thoughts. So, as you said, we're in day 20 mm-hmm. of Operation Epic Fury. And, the same, we mentioned this last time, but the dominant narrative is settled into its usual predicament. And I tip my hat to you for breaking away from this as far as media goes and influencers and podcasters. What's happened is the same thing the globalists want to happen for every issue. You're either for or against the war. Mm-hmm. And whichever side you arbitrarily picked in the beginning, that's the lens through which the war is seen on a day-to-day basis. And, the reason this approach doesn't make any sense and it's not common sense is that the centerpiece of global psychological manipulation is just this, to make every issue a black and white issue that divides mm-hmm. the people and ultimately can be used to control them. And we're seeing that all the major news media, we expect the mainstream media, the globalist media to be anything Trump does, no matter what, whether it makes sense or not, is always bad. But yes. Also we're seeing the influencers, the big podcasters have all seemed to fallen into this trap. And I think the worst thing about this psychological manipulation tool is it prevents you from observing reality with an open mind. And worse, and related to that, is it prevents you from adapting and making good decisions going forward. And I just say this, one of the ways you protect yourself from falling into this black and white issue is to come to grips with the fact you don't know all the facts, mm-hmm. that you need more knowledge to form an opinion. And you should never form an opinion unless that opinion is underpinned by knowledge. And of course here, there's not many people who had knowledge of specifically what the Israeli intelligence knew about what was going on in Iran, what mm-hmm. was actually going on in Iran in reality. None of us knew because Iran has been so locked down. It's such a totalitarian state. And we should never lose sight of what's happened to those people. The thought police, the hanging, the recent hanging of the yeah. young wrestler, that goes on all the time. And these people are still, their voice is not being heard. They're still celebrating. They're still happy about what's happening because they see it as a slight sliver of hope
yes.
that Iran / Persia will return to the greatness that all of those people want and know is possible if they can only break through from this theocracy. So, let's try to understand the patterns as we know them right now in a very general sense mm-hmm. On day 20, and we'll kind of start from the present and work backwards and forward from there. First, the most politically, I'd say, potent criticism of the administration at this point is that they had and they have no end game. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, President Trump's own rhetoric has not helped this. His communication people, and I think he is the head of his own communication.
Yeah.
The oscillation between unconditional surrender and hints at negotiation regime change and denial of regime change, it just feeds the impression of this kind of strategic incoherence.
Do you think that's a tactic? I mean, do you think that is? I'm on the fence. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it's a great point. And with everything with him, I always give him the benefit of the doubt on communication because he's operates at a level that most of us just never spend the time thinking about. Yeah. He's at a PhD level. And I know a big part of what he's done, which I believe is makes some sense, is he's presented to the other world that he means business. And if you want to call him a madman, that's fine. But they, you know, people fear madmen. They fear, you know, unpredictability. And he has presented that to the world and certainly to our adversaries. And, you know, as has been mentioned many times, our adversaries are real. They're both abroad and at home. And perhaps, you know, the worst are here at home, but he's addressing both with his communication strategy. Regardless, you know, I with regards to, you know, 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way around that. That's human nature. A country has to support its military. It has to support its president. And we've got to know, you know, what we're fighting for. We, the people. Yeah. And President Trump has, you know, to be fair, he has discussed that. He has said the purpose, but it's been it's hard to parse through unless you really pay attention. And I went through for a couple hours to spend a couple hours reviewing his press conferences and what he said. Mm-hmm. And he has talked about the objectives, and they're really fivefold. Number one was the missile capability. Number two was their Air Force and ADA, Air Defense Artillery, with anti-aircraft, in layman speak. Their Navy was number three. Number four was the nuclear weapon industrial capacity. So not just the precursors for a nuclear bomb, but the ability to make one. So the labs and the machine shops where everything is done. And then number five is regime leadership. And when you look at what's actually happened to those five key pillars, you know, the ballistic missile arsenal, the nuclear infrastructure, air defenses, Navy, and of course the proxy command architecture, the picture is definitely not of U.S. and Israeli failure. It's one of systemic phased degradation of a threat that previous administrations allowed to grow for four decades. When people, you know, people are scratching their heads going, where are they getting all these drones? Where are they getting all these missiles? Well, they've been building those arsenals for four decades. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, people, I get a lot of great comments from people about our episodes. And one of the questions someone brought up was, why do you think Iran had so many missiles, so many launchers, so many drones? And the only answer, or the most prominent answer you can come up with, is they were preparing to use them. And I don't think they believed, they've been lulled for 40 years into no U.S. president is going to do anything kinetic against them. Trump is the outlier. This is back to your thing about his strategic acumen when it comes to communication. He's the outlier. And I said I'd go backwards and forward. I'll jump forward now a bit. It shouldn't be lost on anyone that they're holding on by their fingernail strategy at this point is to somehow outweigh Trump.
Last. Yeah.
And exactly. And if we can just get another president in there, if he can lose, the midterms, if he can get, you know, if we can get him to lose in 28, those, that's what their strategy has turned into. And of course, again, jumping forward and backwards, that's been their negotiation strategy for 46 years.
Yeah.
We said it last time, Victor Davids Hanson continues to call it out. Some have criticized that the administration walked away from the negotiations too quickly, but that doesn't take into account patterns of behavior that have been etched in stone over decades, which is the Iranians demur, delay, agree to incremental, you know, concessions, and then violate those concessions, lie about the fact they agreed to them, and never follow anything that they say. And that's not being hyperbolic. You can go back and look at every negotiation and every negotiator's comments.
So just to hit on something you said, how are they doing all this? How are they creating all this? Well, it's money. And, you know, the $6 billion that Obama gave them in cash comes to mind. But also, Karj Island is the money machine. So now Trump is talking about, you know, joint coverage of the Strait of Hormuz. I think he, you know, it just kind of clicked in my mind. Maybe he doesn't want that money machine turned back on to rebuild all this.
Yeah. You know? Yep. Well, and that's going to be part of the dilemma, even if we come to an agreement and walk away right now. There's nothing to say they can't just, you know, they can't just save revenue for a while and begin restocking their arsenal from North Korea, Russia, and China, who will be more than happy to sell them what they need. So, you know, it really is the totalitarian theocracy, in my opinion, that's the center of gravity here. And, you know, that brings us back to the intelligence. So let's look at what's happened. The missile launch capacity has fallen by over 90% from 350 a day to in the start to roughly 25 at the present. Same thing with drone. They were at 800 a day on day one to about 50 today. So, you know, the air, the missile, and drone threat.
Announcement. We have such a great cultural fit as companies. So we're very, very excited to be Embraer's newest customer. We launched our airline in April of 21. And our target is focusing on small secondary airports of large metro areas. We've carried over 8 million customers since we started on 63,000 flights. And we've done all these things with 1,200 of the greatest crew members I could ever imagine having. And many of them are here with me today. This is the right airplane for us. It's going to open up opportunities for us that no other aircraft can serve. The best thing about the airplane, of course, is you will not find a middle seat on this airplane. It doesn't exist. We won't have any to offer. It's going to be the best cabin in the United States, and we're so excited about that. This is going to elevate our experience to the highest level, and we think our customers are absolutely going to love the airplane.
That has definitely been attrited and is on its last legs. Naval assets, the fast attack craft, the midget subs, the mine laying capability, that's all been liquidated. And their air defenses have been suppressed to the point which the U.S. is now flying B-1 non-stealth bombers over Iranian airspace, which usually is a signal for total air dominance. So people have to understand that. Now add in the 48 key leaders that are no longer alive, and you have to understand this is unprecedented inside intelligence that I never remember in any modern war or conflict that we've been in before. Just think of how hard it was to find UBL and Zarqawi in Afghanistan. It took 10 years to find UBL and Zarqawi 20. And human hunting for a human who knows they're hunted and has the assets to evade those hunters is one of the most difficult things there is. But somehow, and not somehow, there's no other way that this could be happening without incredible inside intelligence. And that should inform something else about anyone's approach to this war. You know, where can we go from here? Well, we just said it, you know, the totalitarian theocracy needs to fall. The mm-hmm. people of Iran need to be liberated and then choose their own course, their own leaders, their own future, but it not being a this theocratic totalitarian regime that we have right now, which is a threat to the entire Middle East.
Let me jump in there real quick because I just want to hawk my own book, Paying the Price, The Untold Story of the Iranian Resistance. I spent a lot of time with the Iranian resistance in Albania and in Paris. There are diaspora all over the world. And if you want to know how to take down the regime from the inside without a war, I mean, why not use the force on the ground that's proved itself in battle? So back to you.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, everything from the kinetic activity to the human activity mm-hmm. just tells us what kind of intelligence is out there, and that informs the future. You know, what can happen next? Well, a number of things. One of which is, if we have these insiders, we've got to take it to the next level. They've got to be capable of, you know, this final bit of inertia to overthrow the theocracy. So, you know, are we going to arm the resistance? Are we going to augment the resistance with the Kurds or another Shiite proxy force? Those are options that I'm sure are being discussed. I would not talk about them any further at this point, but they're, instead of looking at this as this dead end street, people should be understanding that it is actually following a logical progression of events. There are phases that are unfolding right in front of us. And then much of, again, this criticism of, about the campaign focuses on the costs. You know, the Strait of Hormuz being closed, the price mm-hmm. of a barrel of oil. And the problem with that obsessive focus is it treats the status quo ante as if it were cost-free, and it's not. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, recent history, the biggest failure ID'd by the 911 Commission report, the first was ideological, was a failure of imagination, but the second was a failure to act. And that specifically was in 1998 under Bill Clinton, where he demurred. He would not take action, even though we had this incredible intelligence on UBL. He did not know he was hunted. He was still using his cell phone. But we decided to play it safe, go kinetic. Clinton decided to bomb Khoust, training camp at Khoust, and one in Africa. Neither one had any effect at all. And 9/11 happened 3 years later. And for 20 years, we fought the global war against terrorists. So, you know, this doing nothing is not cost-free. And obsessing on present costs without looking at the future is illogical. And so remember, Iran admitted to open the negotiations with Wyckoff that they could still make 11 nuclear weapons. I think they had 400. They said they had 440 kilograms of enriched uranium at 60% purity. They told us that. So now we know they have ballistic missiles that can hit targets 2,500 kilometers away. They can hit anything in Europe. Everything that anyone was saying about the potential threat from Iran has been proven to be true. And so, again, making a decision, taking a position without including the potential for what happens if we don't act is a fool's errand.
Yes.
So, again, where to next? Standoff wars have one big limitation. You're very familiar with this as an Air Force strategic guy. What do you do when you run out of targets? And we are definitely running out of targets. I think the last number I heard, you may have a better one, was 6,500 targets have been hit. But this is not a throw up your hands. What are we going to do? This is where that superb intel comes in. We have to have some sort of ground plan to assist the resistance. And, you know, I read you those five objectives that I parsed from Trump's statements. But I would, if I was recommending and advising the administration, I'd tell them they should fold those into one specifically, and that's to liberate the people of Iran at this point. Regime change is incomplete. We've already changed the regime, but, you know, like whack-a-mole, another theocratic fanatic pops up to take his place. So, the real goal is to liberate the people of Iran and let them decide what their future should portend.
Well, let me just, I mentioned I've spent time with the resistance. I mean, and they're asking for arms now in the public. So this is the 10-point plan they want to put in place once they come into power. Universal suffrage, that means women, of course, political freedom, the abolition of the death penalty, secular government, equality, independent judiciary, defense of human rights, market economy, pursuit of peace, and no nuclear weapons. So to me, that sounds like a hell of an outcome. So, and I'm not being paid by them or anything. I did write this book because I spent a lot of time with them, but I think that needs to be considered at least to let the people of Iran rebuild their own country. So that's kind of where we're at. And, you mentioned I'm an Air Force guy, and I spent time at the academy and studied strategic air power, but I really worked for the Army when I got out for JSOC, and I, flew guys like you around in and out of the target areas. So to me, that's what you're going to have that kind of operation on the coast in the Strait of Hormuz to dig out all these, like in Fallujah, house to house, you're going to have to go through there and dig all that out. The small attack boats that are hidden and all that stuff. So that, I don't know how they're going to do. So any thoughts on that before we move to Russia?
Yeah, I think that's the whole why the 82nd, as you mentioned in the beginning, was alerted and potentially going to deploy. I don't know there's any other way than, ground guys walking along the coast and securing those caves and those firing positions that have all the anti-ship missiles. Now, having said all that, you mentioned Karg Island, the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has no revenues unless their ships pass through the Strait of Hormuz too. And China, now with Venezuela gone, is 100% dependent on Iranian oil. So, another criticism that's been waged is that this closure of the Strait of Hormuz was something that the, administration never thought about. And, the only way a politician could possibly say that is if they're either denying reality or they've never talked to anyone in the military, because there's probably 1,000 versions of the defend the Strait of Hormuz plan. And I mean that 1,000, because every year, every command that has anything to do with the Middle East, CENTCOM is overall in charge, goes through that plan, refines it, updates it with new weapon systems, new ship capacities and speeds and capabilities. So we have plans on top of plans about the Strait of Hormuz, and the Iranians know that. But the Iranians have always been on the edge of this strategic dilemma. If they close the strait, they close themselves off to any revenue and to their also main source of goods and services.
So if they shut down the revenue, if we shut down the revenue, then they can't pay the IRCG, which is the enforcer. And so that you get turncoats there, but also the people are going to be really angry if you can't buy food and water. And that's another thing I hope they're thinking about. I mean, if you shut off the revenue, you're going to have to feed the people. And so that is going to be a big operation, you know, and I think maybe the Venezuelan model where you bring in somebody in the government to manage that, that's already there on the ground. I don't know, but it's something that has to be thought about. Can't just, if you screw over the Iranian people, then that's not going to be a good outcome.
Yeah. Well, so to come back to those 10 points that you read about mm-hmm. what a new regime would do, where did mm-hmm. that come from? Where is that?
It is the specific? You can Google it, the NCRI, National Council of Resistance on Iran 10-point plan. It's in my book, Paying the Price, The Untold Story of the Iranian Resistance. That is what they've been talking about for decades. But there's been a concerted effort in the media and in the U.S. government to stop that from happening. So you've got elements within our government trying to appease the mullahs and go that route for whatever their agenda is, whether they're, you know, Obama sending $6 billion or whatever. I mean, this has been around for a long time. So anyway, back to you.
Well, it needs to be codified and, you know, said out loud and repeated because that's a charter. And, you know, as I said, giving those people hope is part of what will enable them to go through what will not be easy, this final phase, the final overthrow. But, you know, right now they're the overwhelming majority. And it's that the same thing, you know, we've looked at in countries all the time. If everyone can just coordinate and act at once, they could easily overthrow the government. But they need help because Iran is shut down like no totalitarian state we've ever seen. The surveillance devices are everywhere, which, by the way, is, I believe, part of the key to the incredible intelligence we've had. There's cameras. There's 4 cameras at every intersection in Iran. There's cameras on every street. This is mostly for the thought police is what they were put there for. And we tapped into those, the Israelis and the U.S. They've been working against the Iranians since the beginning.
But not to mention now, the phones and email and all that stuff.
Yep. So that's where we're at. You know, the future is, you know, what to do next. The objectives have been stated. Most of them have been accomplished or are almost accomplished. Iran has lost its ability to wage war outside its borders. That is the bottom line, and it's incredibly important. That's why there's so much support from the rest of the Middle East.
Your government doesn't care about you. That's why you need a medical emergency kit. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, Z-Pak, and antibiotics. Stock them before they block them.
It's tough, but your finances don't have to be. I'm David Cross, and I'm a certified divorce financial analyst practitioner. My job is to help you get a fair financial settlement in your divorce and to guide you to smarter money decisions. Find out how we can help you. U.S. Asset Management, it's your money and your future.
Especially the Saudis, who see the Iranians as an existential threat. And I don't believe they see them that way anymore, except for the fact they still are kicking. They still have those precursors to a nuclear weapon, that 440 kilograms of enriched uranium. And so it needs to be finished off. But what to do next, how to get the resistance into power, that's going to be what the key decisions and the key actions that need to happen in the near future.
All right. So I think we've beat that horse. Let's move to Russia. Russia's profiting right now. Oil, fertilizer prices are way up. This is playing right into their hands. I read something this morning just before the show that they were going to have to tap some of their rainy day funds, and now they don't have to. So they're delaying that. And they're being seen as a possible negotiator. So yeah. Russia's going to look good out of all this, right?
Yeah. And again, on that, you know, to anyone who thinks that's a factor, it should be, who cares? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, we can't be like making strategic moves and then changing them based on, well, that would help Russia out too much. Russia kind of deserves to get the benefit of this. They've been the object of the globalist ire now, you know, since at least 2022, but way yeah. before that, obviously back to 14 and 13. They've been patient, and they are a solution. They have direct communication with Iran, at least some of Iranian leaders. You know that those planes flew to Moscow the day before the invasion started, the bombing started. Three planes flew to Moscow out of Iran. No idea what was on them or who was on them. But Iran or Russia has power over Iran and could definitely assist. And this is back to that quid pro quo thing that we were talking about. I believe there is communication between the U.S. and Iran. We heard, and this came from the ground, that that Putin and his emissaries had told the U.S. that, hey, we'll be happy to not provide Iran with any more intelligence as long as you give us your word you're not going to provide Ukraine with any intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, to guys like you and me, that should be a no-brainer, because yeah. we've been advocating for cutting off everything since Trump took over in January of 2025. So
yes.
I think it's a natural byproduct of what's happened. We should be working with them. We should be seeing if there's a solution they can help out with. And as you said, they're profiting from the higher oil prices. They're profiting from the lack of attention. They're profiting from the sanctions have completely failed. The, you know, EU's round 20 of sanctions were based on a price for a barrel of oil that we're now way beyond. So yeah. there are everything about their sanctions fell apart. So there's no more sanctions. The U.S. lifted the sanction on Russia oil to ease the global market, so, you know, there wouldn't be this global recession. And so who cares? You know, Russia is just reaping the benefit of their own forethought and their own consistency in strategy and philosophy. I think on the battlefield, the same thing is happening. I had the pleasure of talking to someone who just came back, mm-hmm. one of my sources, contacts, friends, and you know, he said the following about Kyiv, that Kyiv is a completely different place than it was even a year ago. Wow. There's definitely a belief amongst the people of Kyiv that the war needs to stop. Whereas even a year ago, you never heard people openly talking negatively about Zelensky and his regime. Now that's all they talk about. Everyone fears that it is not just a matter of time. It's a matter of a short period of time before Russians pull into Kyiv. And the reason for that is the Zaporizhia front coming up from the south along the Dnieper River is collapsing daily. That's where the big gains are being made. That's where Ukraine has put as much of its reserves as possible. But Russia continues to make gains northward toward Kyiv. And so the people, he said, it's without a doubt different from the way it used to be. very few bars are open now. There's still some bars, which is what attracts so many of these Europeans and Americans. They're still open, the high-end ones, but anywhere else, grocery stores are closed. There's lines everywhere, and we're not seeing any of this because, you know, the Ukrainian media is controlled by Zelensky and Soros 100%. So just like Iran, you can't see what's really happening in the country. And Russia's taking advantage of it, and they realize, hey, the U.S. is going to be bogged down in this now. There's not going to be an ability to give any more Patriot missiles or anti-drone lasers and cutting-edge technology when all that needs to be used in the Middle East. So
I've got the map there. People can see Zaporizhia kind of halfway down the red area towards Crimea. So just so our audience can see that.
Yeah. So, you know, the Russians seen it as net hugely positive. And of course, Zelensky is crawling the walls, flipping out, criticizing everyone. Yesterday, he came out and said something about the U.S. and not being able to win. He's volunteered. And this really was another topic of discussion in Kyiv. He keeps volunteering the Ukrainian military to come and help fight against the Iranians. And people are saying, why would we send people here when we're on the edge of being overthrown, of losing our entire country? You want to, the one thing you think our country can help provide is military. Yeah. And so, you know, we said it last time, actors begin to break down when they have no one to act to, when they have, you know, no script. And he not only doesn't have a script, but no one, there's no cameras pointed at him. So what does he do? He's probably doubling down on getting involved in what the military is doing. The next thing I want to say about Kyiv, and really the final thing, is they've gone, the recruiting, the forced recruiting and conscription has gone from bad to unbelievable, as worse as it could possibly be. They're grabbing everybody. There's no exemptions anymore. They're just blanketing the city. They tripled the size of the conscriptor force. They're armed now. They're not allowing civilians to overwhelm them. It's horrific. And again, you'd think that would not be an issue, but desperate men make desperate moves, and it's desperate times in Ukraine right now.
So there's no more gold facelifts, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And that was a reference. The money was flowing so fast in Ukraine a few years ago that women were getting gold face, not facelifts, but what's it called, where they, you know, massage your
infuse
face.
It or whatever.
Yeah. Kind of crazy. All right. So I hear that's enough on Ukraine. We get it. I hear your interview, your 12-hour interview is about to drop, my friend. Do you have any update on that?
You know, I've already set dates twice and they changed them, and it's now scheduled for the 6th of April. I guess I got bumped by Joe Kent, who did an interview yesterday or whatever, but that, you know, I can't control that. I like Sean a lot, and it was great hanging out with him, but 4-6 is the date that it's supposed to go on. And it's good. I was ready to quit at 3 hours. He wouldn't let me. You know, he said, we got to go through every combat zone that you've been through. And in the end, you know, it was a great experience. And like I said, it's great talking to him, great hanging out with him for 2 or 3 days.
And for our audience, we'll put it up on armedforces.press when it drops. I guess it's going to come out in parts from what I hear.
I'm not sure. They're not, I'm not involved in that part, but if it comes out, you know, it's 12 hours. It was filmed over 2 sessions. And, you know, I'll probably watch it. It's hard for me to watch myself on anything, but I'll watch it like a mini series. I'll do an hour here, an hour there, and eventually get to the whole thing.
Well, your fan club's saying here, and can't wait to watch.
Awesome.
So, Pete, thank you, my friend. We'll have you back. Of course, we'll do another. I think we're going to have a lot to talk about in the next few weeks to months.
So, yep. See you next Tuesday.
All right. Take